The Athletic.
The race is on, and starting 14th on the grid was no impediment to Max Verstappen taking what was ultimately a dominant victory in the Belgian Grand Prix. But what made Red Bull so fast, and is this the shape of things to come for the second half of the season? I'm Ed Straw, and joining us to tackle those questions and many more are Scott Mitchell-Malm and Mark Hughes. Mark, how are you doing? We haven't heard from you for a few podcasts. Had a good weekend?
Yes. I've certainly enjoyed watching that race, even though the outcome was much as a lot of people predicted. It was fun watching it unfold, watching how it unfolded. And it's just an extraordinary performance, wasn't it?
Yeah, massively so, and lots of question marks over exactly how that happened that we'll get into. But actually, Mark, have you met our new podcast regular, Scott Mitchell-Malm?
I used to know a guy who looked like him with a similar name, but no, I haven't met this guy yet.
I've seen this new guy's byline on the race website. I hope that he writes a lot more sense than the last guy, because the last guy was just absolutely full of it.
Yeah, I second that.
I don't know. I've read some of the comments on some of your stories, and I'm not sure that the new guy is convincing people that he's sensible. But I'll let our listeners take a look at our writings and make up their own mind.
Yeah, I've in my new form, I have appeared on a couple of podcasts now, and I haven't said anything as ridiculous as that guy Scott Mitchell said in our Hungarian Grand Prix review podcast right at the very end, where I emphatically declared that Fernando Alonso would definitely not have an Aston Martin contract after the summer break.
Yes, we may have clipped that out as well and played it in our Alonso signs for Aston Martin episode, but it's always good to bring it back up again. But the basic reason, if you're wondering why Scott Mitchell-Malm is Scott Mitchell-Malm, it's because he's become a little bit more Swedish by marriage. So congratulations, Scott. Now, Mark, the fact that Max Verstappen set the pace in qualifying by over 0.6 of a second and then breezed to the front from 14th on the grid after power unit change penalties tells you exactly how this race was won. It was just sheer pulverizing pace. So my question for you is less about how the race was won, but more why was Red Bull, or to be more precise, Verstappen, so stunningly quick at Spa?
Three components to that. Max Verstappen himself, the Red Bull suitability to the track, and Ferrari's underperformance. And it was clear that when you strip the downforce off, which you need to do for Spa because of those long flat-out stretches, it became apparent just how much more efficient the Red Bull's aerodynamics are than the Ferrari's at that very low downforce level. And that's not something we've seen so far this year. And it's also the fact that the compromise you have to make in the setup for Spa makes for a car which, if you want to have good response through the slow stuff, through the bus stop and the source, it ideally it's going to have a little bit of an edgy balance through the long, fast middle sector. If you're going to set it up like that, you need a driver totally at ease with a very neutral car at very high speeds, which is quite a demanding thing. And Verstappen was perfect for that. And he was absolutely on a mission coming into the weekend. You know, he came in knowing that he was going to be taking those power unit penalties. So he knew that he couldn't just afford to be the fastest. He was going to need to be more than just the fastest. He was going to need to really have no compromise in performance at all. And that's what they said about doing. And fantastic performance. And Sergio Perez just couldn't live with him in the same car. He's running a much more understeery balance through. Just, he was asked after his first Q3 lap, Checo, he was told Max's time, which was about 0.8 faster than his, and was asked, look, do you want to take some front flap out? And he thought about it for a long time and just said, no, I can't carry any more front flap. He just told you how on edge that car felt to Checo, and just what an extraordinary job Max did with it and how easy he was with it. And his direction change through those corners was just amazing. It was, you could just watch it on the screen. It was just unbelievably good. And yeah, the other thing was that the increase in track temperature on race day, which turned the race from a likely one stop into a definite two, induced massive thermal degradation of the tyres, and Max's car was just so much better balanced that it really wasn't an issue for him. And even starting on the softs, he was still, you know, quite happy running along. And yeah, he set a fastest lap on the race with 28 kilos, around 28 kilos of fuel still on board. It was lap 32. And, you know, when Leclerc tried it on brand new soft tyres with, you know, near empty tanks right at the end, he was 6/10 off that. So it just gives an idea of just how dominant the car and Verstappen were.
It's absolutely unbelievable that you go into a race with a driver starting 14th and it just felt predictable that he would win. Really, really astonishing. Mm. And just to come back to that Perez comparison, I suggest if anyone wants to really see the difference, watch the onboard of their qualifying laps at Puan. You can just see how much difference Verstappen just carries so much speed through the corner. He's on that first bit of curb and just all takes it as one. Perez is like he's in a different car, just absolutely unbelievable.
The thing I noticed when I was looking through sort of Verstappen's performance relative to the Ferraris, but Perez as well, was just that, just how easy he made it look like that car had so much performance in all three sectors. I hadn't really clocked it until there was something I was working on before we recorded this on Sunday evening, where I needed to go back over qualifying. And I know fastest laps in the race are a bit misleading, but their fastest sectors in qualifying and their fastest sectors in the race. And I was stunned to see that Verstappen was just quicker than all of them in every single sector. And I just feel like that's such a rare thing to see at Spa for the reasons that have been talked about. It was just Verstappen sort of making a mockery of how difficult it's meant to be to balance a car like this. He was just supreme. Leclerc said something like Red Bull were on another level this weekend, but I don't think that's fair. I think Verstappen was, because Perez had the same car and didn't look like that at all.
And the thing is, you can have situations where a car and driver package have the pace, but there's so many things you can trip over. But drivers of Verstappen's caliber just make it look so easy.
And that's what I really liked about Verstappen's drive. I was on board with him for the majority of the race, but in particular at the start, paying very close attention at the start. And Ed, you said earlier that it's amazing to go into a race like this and think that the guy in starting 14th, it's inevitable they're going to win. We've seen Lewis Hamilton at the peak of the Mercedes dominance have races that have become complicated, like he's fallen into the pack or he started further down, never quite this low. But you know those races where he just gets the job done? He sort of ticks away. He's patient in the beginning. He waits. He survives. And then if he's had to fall back a little bit, so be it, because you take one step or two steps backwards to take several forwards. And Lewis was always really good at this. I think that one of the best examples I can think of off the top of my head was that drive in Turkey to win the championship in 2020, where he just almost had to wait for everything to come his way. And he was just so good and so effective with it. And the reason I bring that up is purely because I can't think of any higher praise to give Verstappen than compare this drive to that caliber of drive. Arguably, this was better because it was further down on the grid. Yeah, there was a safety car, but that only really mitigated a small amount of gap that had developed on the opening lap. And obviously, it was a dry race with no other drama, and yet Max was able to pick his way through in just such a methodical way. The first lap in front of him was absolute chaos. Cars all over the place, cars rejoining off from the gravel, a car pulling over to the side and slowing down. He was having to jink left and right to react really quickly to what was in front of him, judge how aggressive to be. He put a great move on Leclerc after briefly losing out to him in the middle of the lap. But in all of that, he still managed to rise from 14th on the grid to 8th at the end of the first lap. He had a great launch, and it was just, he just did a superb job of turning a focus on survival into a focus on very, very efficient progress up the order, and then just searing pace once it opened up in front of him. It was just it was an absolutely perfect drive. It was a total masterclass and a sign of just how good a driver Verstappen is, but also just how confident and almost freely he's driving now as this season progresses. He's a world champion, but he looks like someone who is just absolutely reveling in the way that this season is developing.
You mentioned, Mark, all the reasons why the Red Bull was so strong. Do you think this is just a one-off because of the nature of the circuit? It's an unusual compromise circuit between the first and third sectors and the middle one. Or could this be just a sign that Red Bull are going to be crushingly dominant? It's going to be a Vettel second half of 2013 style run.
I suspect that the advantage we saw this weekend is going to be the biggest we'll see this season. But I also suspect that the soul searching and the big crisis meetings that will be happening at Ferrari as they try to figure out how to try and combat this will probably only increase Red Bull's confidence, and I think we will in terms of results probably still see a dominant Verstappen in the second half of the season. But I think in terms of raw performance, I don't think we're going to see anything like we saw at Spa this weekend. I think this was just absolutely perfect for reasons that only became evident through this weekend. In terms of the performance of the car at various ride heights and with very low downforce levels on it, this really was only exposed as the weekend got underway. But I don't think any of those things will really apply in the remaining races. Monza, obviously Ferrari's low downforce package will be even lower downforce, and there must be a worry about that for them. But the other tracks, no, I would expect them still to be back where they were, competing with Red Bull on pace. But Red Bull and Verstappen are just, operating at a higher level, even when their performance is roughly the same, which it wasn't this weekend, obviously. But even when they are, they're just, we've seen it far too many races now to come to any other conclusion. So no, I see them continuing to dominate the results. But I think this will go down as absolute peak advantage.
Christian Horner said after the race that it felt reminiscent, in fact, the most reminiscent since the time of that dominance in kind of 2013, 2011 time when Red Bull was just absolutely demolishing the opposition. It's just with the difference that it came from down the grid. Scott, let's talk a little bit about Ferrari's race. Sainz in third place was about as good as he could have done, wasn't it? The Ferrari wasn't going to be beating Red Bulls. But there were times when he flirted with falling into the clutches of George Russell. But with Leclerc, there were also some blunderous moments, weren't there?
Yeah, this felt like another race where the sort of inherent pace of that car was obvious over the course of the weekend. Yeah, it wasn't on the Red Bull level, but obviously it was still comfortably clear of anyone else. And ultimately, Sainz was able to get ahead of Perez and claim that net pole position once Verstappen was out of the picture. And then the race, it just slightly unravels a little bit. My big takeaway from not the Grand Prix itself, because I guess you could probably see it happening, but what Binotto was saying afterwards is I feel like tyre management is a really big concern for them at the moment. Unless I'm remembering it incorrectly, I thought that looked like it might be a bit of a strength of the Ferrari at one point at the very start of the season. But I think from Miami onwards, the Red Bull has looked generally stronger. And I do think it's an underrated strength of Verstappen's as well. But there's just a big emphasis at the moment of understanding why they're not getting the tyres to work as expected. Obviously, in Hungary, it was a different issue. Here, did seem to be that they were working the tyres too hard. And I think that was just ultimately what pegged Sainz back. As for Leclerc, he was... I felt like he was a bit frustrated about the way his race was handled, but again, his focus still afterwards, just every time, kept coming back to that deficit to Red Bull and being absolutely baffled about how the Red Bull had got that quickly. This actually felt like one where, yeah, the Ferrari's handling of the race probably wasn't perfect, and there was obviously a dispute between Leclerc and the team later on. Maybe you can explain that in a little bit more detail, Ed, because I'm rambling on a little bit here, but it felt like one of those races where, even though there were imperfections on the Ferrari side, this was at legitimately one where the underlying performance is a bigger concern. That was the argument they tried to spin in Hungary, but I didn't feel like that was fair. Whereas here, I think it's legitimate to question a few key reasons why the performance wasn't quite there.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Any strategic problems or mistakes are second order to the pace. I'd agree with that, although there are still some question marks. We'll speak to Mark in a moment a bit more about the strategy, but there was that great conversation with Leclerc about whether he was going to pit, what tyres he was going to go on, and eventually they extended. But it's good to hear Leclerc really trying to assert himself, and maybe Ferrari trying to elicit his opinion a little bit more to help him to do that. But of course, it was that late pit stop, the switch to the soft tyres for a punt at fastest lap that was the thing that Ferrari was criticised for, because he came out, ended up behind Alonso, had to pass him, beat Alonso to fifth on the road, then got the penalty for having sped in the pit lane, which actually brings us back to the tear-off, doesn't it?
Yeah, because there was a burnt sensor, I think, that basically meant that he was in like 0.1 over the speed limit, and it was very unfortunate, but it just feels classic Ferrari, doesn't it, that Leclerc picks up a 5 second penalty that costs him a position and 2 points because of a pit stop he didn't want to make, but Ferrari did, so that he could gain 1 point for fastest lap.
They didn't gain.
Yeah, so it's just that just feels very Ferrari in the middle of a very Ferrari weekend.
Yeah, it's just one of those things. And the pit stop for Leclerc wasn't particularly slow. The in-pit lane time was within the bounds of normality. It wasn't stunningly quick, but it also wasn't particularly slow. So yeah, a high risk for grabbing that point, and it bit them. Mark, as always, we have some questions from the Race Members Club to answer. Head to theRace.com and don't forget the hyphen and click on Join the Race to find out more. Our first question is from Sean Murphy, who asks, do you have any idea why Ferrari put Sainz on hards while at the same time they put Leclerc on mediums? Given Sainz was going to come under threat from Russell, it seemed an odd decision. Starting on softs meant he could have used mediums for the rest of the race. Now, Mark, this refers to that double shuffle pit stop Ferrari did on lap 25 for Sainz's final stint, doesn't it? So can you explain that disparity?
I think probably Sainz's concern, because his rear tyre deg was so extraordinarily high, much higher than anticipated, was he wanted to ensure he got to the end, basically. That sounds ridiculous, but it was really very, very high, the deck. So he went on the hards. I think in Leclerc's positioning, you know, they could afford to be a bit more adventurous. So they were thinking of, you know, trying to move forwards rather than defending from what Sainz had to do against Russell. But fundamentally, the car was just not working very well, and there wasn't a clear right answer because the tyre picture was, you know, so volatile and so much different to anything that had been modelled by anyone.
And our final question on Ferrari, Scott, comes from Sarah Morris, who says, first of all, great race, and I'm so glad Spa is on the calendar for yet another year. That, of course, is the news that Spa will be on the 2023 calendar, given Kyle Army won't be happening next year. But the actual question is, was the Ferrari strategy good enough today, or was that the best they could manage?
I think that was probably about right. Ultimately, weren't quick enough, and Leclerc's race was compromised early on by that tear off. So Sainz was never going to beat Verstappen. Probably never going to beat Perez once Perez pulled his finger out. Like, I don't really think it should have ever been in doubt that Perez was going to beat Sainz. But Perez made life harder for himself by not being good enough in qualifying, and then had a really poor first lap. So that's what I guess gave Sainz a sniff, but I didn't really feel it was ever realistic with the pace delta between the cars. And then, yeah, as I say, Leclerc was always on damage limitation job in that race with a slightly slower car than Verstappen and a less potent one in the straight line. And then it got massively complicated early on with that pit stop under the safety car. So, yeah, I think you can still poke holes in the way Ferrari handled this race, but it wasn't the defining factor.
Yep, strategy doesn't make your car faster, and a faster car makes strategy a lot easier. That's just the way of things in Formula One. Well, Scott, before we get into the Mercedes troubles specifically this weekend, let's have a quick look at the first lap incident that put Lewis Hamilton out of the race. He clashed with Fernando Alonso at Les Combes. So what's your verdict on that?
That was Lewis's fault. Yeah, there was. I don't think there's any doubt on that. I at first, when I saw it the first time, I thought maybe Alonso had just understeered into him because he didn't really get a good shot of it when it was live, or what I saw wasn't very clear. But then as soon as you got into the onboards, or even, to be honest, like a replay from the external cameras, it was just very clear. Lewis has either misjudged exactly how much space Alonso was left on the inside, or he thought he was clear and could just turn in. But it was slam dunk Lewis's fault. Fernando could not have been more to the right. He was actually on over the inside curb. He was completely completely in control. There was no sign of Alonso understeering out, and just a silly misjudgment from Hamilton. I mean, it happens on the opening lap, I suppose. The steward sort of dismissed it as a first lap incident. That's why they opted not to include a penalty. And Fernando afterwards, to be fair, I know he was very, very angry at the time, and he called Lewis an idiot, and he said that this guy only knows how to, you know, lead from the front, basically, which I thought was a little bit uncharitable. But after the race, Fernando was a lot more sort of circumspect about it and said these things do happen. I don't think it wasn't intentional or anything. Like, he seemed to accept that Hamilton had just made a mistake, but it absolutely was Hamilton's fault. There's no getting around that. And it's a big and costly blunder, because I don't think that Mercedes was ever going to really be in the fight for a podium, but he would have beaten Russell. It would have been big points for the team. And it's a fairly rare case, it has to be said, but a case nonetheless of Hamilton letting him and Mercedes down.
Yeah, an open and shut case, and a little bit of natural justice, because it put Hamilton out of the race and Alonso was able to continue undamaged and, of course, got fifth place in the end. Mark, Mercedes headed here to Spa with some optimism, with the technical director introducing the porpoising metric and the changes to the floor to stop people taking liberties with the plank, as well as, of course, some promising performances before the break. But in qualifying, the car was horrendously slow. So what went wrong, and why was George Russell then suddenly able to threaten Sainz on his way to fourth in the race, given what happened on Saturday?
It's the bugbear of tyres again, and it's, you know, the pattern that we've seen throughout the season. It's This Mercedes really struggles to switch the tyres on. You can see how aggressive both drivers were being on their outlaps in practice and in qualifying. And that's the same reason. It's just not putting the energy into the tyres, and that's the same reason it's actually reasonably good on range. It's not that the car becomes better. It's just that it's treating its tyres gently. It's still an inherently slower car than a Ferrari or a Red Bull, but it sometimes can show artificially well against them, because it's just given the tyres an easier time. And when that's a factor, when the range of the your stint range is a factor in the race, then it can become a more convincing looking car. And because Ferrari was struggling so much with tyre deck here, and Mercedes slightly less so, it gave George half a sniff of a chance at attacking Sainz, and he got sort of close. I think he got the closest was 1.8 seconds, but then ran a bit wide, and then it takes you another three laps to get back up again, and you just basically ran out of laps. But the car wasn't any worse or better relative to the Ferrari than it usually is. It was just light years behind a Red Bull.
Yeah, and just shows as well that Mercedes still has some things they need to get on top of. The tyre situation has been something they've struggled with a bit in the past, so lots of work still to do there. Well, let's catch up with progress on Grid Rival, which is a fantasy motorsport game that the race has its own league in. My team only managed 885 points this week, despite what I thought was a pretty strong lineup of Verstappen, Perez, Sainz, Leclerc, Albon and Williams. Was it enough to beat you, Scott?
I think I've managed to beat you despite forgetting to set a talent driver.
I think I may have done the same.
Ah, okay.
It was meant to be Albon.
Yeah, because you were bragging and saying, "Oh, yeah, Albon, talent driver." No, I had a pretty good week despite Hamilton's DNF, which cost me because I had Mercedes as my team. I had quite a good week, and it would have been actually a really good week if I'd got the double points for Albon as a talent driver. So yeah, it was fine. I'm so bad at playing the budgets, the rise and falls in this game, that I forget that every week I remember. Yet you need to hit the rises, and then you've got, and you can just constantly build a stronger and stronger team. Because I see some of the top teams in this league, and they've got basically everyone that's mega. And how do you afford these people? And then I see that their team value is just miles higher than mine. But then by the time it comes to then pick the team, I then get really excited, release a bunch of tuggers, pick some people that I really want, and all of a sudden my team values nothing again. Never learn.
There's a lot of strategy in this game. It's not just about picking who you think is going to do well on a given weekend, which is what gives it that extra bite. The leader in our league is still Ranul Dicardo, with Alonso, Leclerc, Verstappen, Ricciardo, Russell and Red Bull as part of a pretty mighty lineup. So well done there. Grid Rival is still open for signups if you'd like to join in for the rest of the season. So download the Grid Rival app or visit the website so you can get involved. The link's in the episode description for this podcast. Well, Scott, after being in the headlines for all the wrong reasons for losing drivers at a rate of knots, Alpine actually had a pretty good weekend. Alonso was fifth after that Leclerc post-race penalty, and Ocon seventh despite his grid penalty. Chris Parrott asks, what does it say about Alpine versus McLaren championship battle that Norris and Ocon started alongside each other on the grid, but the latter made it to seventh and the former was stuck in 12th? It seemed to me that McLaren compromised Ricciardo's strategy to bring in Norris ahead of him in the final round of stops. Is this the kind of service he can expect for the remainder of the season, given he's out at the end of the year?
That's not what happened. That they didn't pit Ricciardo to put him behind Norris or anything like that. The way that the race was playing out for Ricciardo, they were trying something, I think, a bit maverick to get ahead of Albon and actually get him into the top 10, but it didn't work. It cost him track position. He didn't have anywhere near as much of a pace advantage on a tyre offset, and that car was slow in a straight line because there was a problem. McLaren brought a bunch of lower drag parts for this weekend, including a new rear wing. But Ricciardo's had a problem that had to be changed on Saturday, and they only had one for each driver at Spa. So Ricciardo had to go to a slightly higher downforce and therefore slower rear wing, which left him a sitting duck and left him basically unable to really attack on the straight. So once he'd given up the track position in that late pit stop, he couldn't gain the positions back. But that situation only arose because Ricciardo had lost some track position early on, dropped behind Albon in the first place. So it was quite complicated for Ricciardo. He knew basically from lap five, which was, I think, the safety car restart lap or the lap after that, that he was in for a long afternoon, because he could see that unless he was in the tow and had DRS, he was just absolutely helpless on the straights. So I don't think that was a sort of attitude thing from McLaren towards Ricciardo. I think this weekend McLaren just lacked, a bit like Baku, where the defining element of their weekend was that they didn't have the pace in the high speed parts. They didn't have the pace really this weekend either. And whereas the Alpine just looked really potent throughout. So it was a great weekend for Alpine, really strengthened their bid for fourth in the championship. And at the moment, I would say that McLaren is not looking lost, but is really on the back foot in that fight. And my fictional money would be on Alpine at the moment, because that car just looks quite strong. It just looks like a really nice all-round car, and it seems to be working everywhere as the McLaren's going through these peaks and troughs.
Yeah, and every time they put new parts on the car, they seem to work as well, which hasn't always been a strength in the past. We should briefly mention the imminent contract recognitions board activity regarding Oscar Piastri's deal. Of course, he is off to McLaren. Alpine claim they have him under contract. We're expecting that to be, well, not entirely dealt with, but the CRB will look at it on Monday. We may have news on Monday about what they rule. What are you expecting to happen there, Scott?
Well, from everything I've heard and what people are saying on the record and what you're reading between the lines, I'm expecting the CRB to side with McLaren, and therefore I would therefore expect pretty soon after that Oscar Piastri will be announced as a McLaren driver for 2023. Alpine does still have a chance. I don't think it's 100% in McLaren's favour by any means. You never know how these things are going to go. I don't know what's in the contract. Very, very, very few people have seen the full Piastri Alpine contract, so who knows what the CRB and their the members of that panel will actually conclude. But my expectation would be that CRB does side with McLaren on Piastri. Beyond that, even if the CRB sided with Alpine, I don't think Piastri will be an Alpine driver next year. I think whatever happens, Alpine will be in the McLaren next season. I think the CRB will just go a long way to deciding how much McLaren has to pay for that privilege.
And we will have probably another podcast with news of what happens there when we know exactly what's going on. Piastri, we should add, was on simulator driver duty for Alpine. He didn't come to the circuit, but he was there in Enstone making his contribution, doing his work. So still very much part of the team for now, at the very least. Now, Mark, Aston Martin, still not especially competitive, particularly in qualifying, a bit stronger in the race, but Sebastian Vettel managed a pretty tidy eighth place ahead of AlphaTauri's Pierre Gasly. Do you think that's evidence he's determined not to coast in the closing half season of his F1 career?
Yeah, I think so, probably. Although the last few races, Stroll has been the quicker qualifier and looked generally the quicker guy until the first lap of the weekend when he went onto the gravel and lost a load of places. But, if Seb gets an opportunity, he still puts in the very, very tidy drives, doesn't he? And the car was good on its tyres relative to the cars around it. And I think he was a little bit surprised at how he was able to comfortably keep up with Alonso's Alpine. If the car's halfway there, he'll deliver the results. He will always, be a contender to put the car where it should be.
You missed out one crucial fact there, Mark, that Stroll took a bite of the gravel after being slightly put there while running wheel-to-wheel with his teammate. So a little bit of intra-team rivalry there. I asked Mike Crack about that. He said that sometimes that will happen. He wasn't too worried about it, but good to see some fierce fighting going on there. But Scott, we really do need to talk about Williams, because they had a 8-race points drought coming into this race. Alex Albon finished 10th, having qualified 6th, well, started 6th, he qualified 9th fastest, but in Q3 on merit, he spent most of the race under pressure from various people. So how impressed were you with his nuncial pass act?
Not as impressed as I was with the picture that he tweeted after the race. I don't know if you've seen this. It's a neatly photoshopped. It's very difficult to spot the Photoshop. I recommend people go on Alex's Twitter and find it, but it's basically an edited image where the Williams is considerably wider than it is in reality. I thought that was good social mediaing from Alex to follow up his Piastri mocking and confirmation of his Williams deal earlier in August. So he's getting the hang of Twitter, but he's also getting the hang of this Williams. I thought he was very, very good this weekend. Excellent in qualifying. Sent a really good message for what he and Williams can achieve on their good days. He described it as, if we're perfect, this is what we're capable of. So his first Q3 appearance, the team's first Q3 appearance in the dry. So it was a merited top 10 start. Yes, the sixth place on the grid was because of penalties, but absolutely merited being in Q3. And then a great drive to nick that point. It's not much to write home about in the grand scheme of things, but when you look at the fact that I think he made one or two errors in that race and did cost himself a position at one point, was it to Esteban Ocon? But in general, really, really strong drive and deserved a point. That's what was really good about it. He didn't luck into a position and then hang on. He just did his absolute best to fight gravity, which was always going to be difficult to do. And the upshot was a result that for the first time in a few races breathes a bit of life into Williams's season. This is a bit circuit specific. That car is so fast in the straight line, to use something Alex has said a few times this year, because it doesn't really have any downforce compared to the other cars. But who cares? He made the most of it. He did a great job, and he frustrated a lot of people in faster cars.
Yeah, there are a lot of things that Williams did right as well as Albon this weekend. They bought a relatively cheap upgrade, was what Dave Robson, the head of vehicle performance, described it as. Basically, they cut down their rear wing, and that gave them the reasonable compromise between straight line speed and at least being able to get around that middle sector without losing too much time. They were not quick in the middle sector, but they were at least quick enough not to give away any of what they gained elsewhere. But Alex Albon actually had the fastest sector time of all in qualifying in the first sector, and I think he was 6th fastest in the final sector. So that tells you how quick that car was. Good braking stability. They got the tyres working well. And actually, Albon probably should have done a little bit more in qualifying, but he just took an absolute all-out attack approach to Q3. He knew he was going to be six on the grid, whatever he did. So it was a bit of a free hit, really. And then in the race, he was getting lots of tyre management instructions in terms of, right, you've got to manage this, you've got to manage this. He had quicker cars behind him, but yeah, I can't say he didn't put a foot wrong, because he did have that big lock-up you alluded to, Scott. Went wide at the source, which let Ocon pass. But he's doing very well to keep Ocon behind, because that Alpine was quick and pretty quick on the straights. I spent a lot of the race watching on boards with that group behind Albon, seeing how good people were at passing him. Ocon was probably the one that was giving him the most trouble of everyone who was behind him. But yeah, very, very positive for Williams. A little bit of a shame for Nicholas Latifi that he was hoping for a decent result, but had that spin on the second lap that wiped out poor old Valtteri Bottas early on, which was unfortunate. And, of course, difficult day for Alfa Romeo, given Zhou Guan Yu, the other Alfa Romeo, was in that queue behind Alex Albon with Lance Stroll at the front of it in 11th place. And we should briefly mention AlphaTauri and Pierre Gasly. Difficult weekend for them. But 9th place, well executed from Gasly, considering he started from the pits unexpectedly. What did you make of that, Mark? The AlphaTauri is a bit all over the place at the moment, isn't it? And they've just salvaging a few points for them would have been a bad weekend last year, but now it feels like a bit of a triumph.
Yeah, exactly. It's a mediocre car, really. And it's, you know, at Spa, you can at least play around with the trade-off between the downforce and the straight line. And if you got a driver that can hang on to it through the twisty bits, you probably put an average car a little bit above where it should be. And he was quick through the practices, but when you didn't get it quite into Q3. But it was a very nice comeback race from the garage, because he thought with about 90 seconds to go, he wasn't going to be taking part. So they did the thing, just cut out and had to be pushed off the grid. Some sort of electrical problem, but he did a good job. I think probably apart from obviously Verstappen's comeback, from a poor grid start, and the other one worth a shout out has got to be Esteban Ocon, because he did those two double passes. He passed two cars in one move twice. Yeah, I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, well-executed race from him. In the end, he actually got told that the Alpines will be holding position because he was catching up. The strategy was slightly different, but he was catching Alonso at a rate of knots late on, and they were given the instruction that they would not be changing positions, which actually was quite wise because there was not really anything to gain. And actually, if they'd started battling, perhaps Alonso wouldn't have been in the position to benefit from the Leclerc situation late on. So very well managed by Alpine as well. We'll get back to the pod in a moment, but first, a word about our partner, Grammarly. No matter what kind of work you do, how you communicate is key. All those emails, reports, and presentations are equally important to the collaboration needed to get things done, and Grammarly can help. Grammarly is your AI writing partner to help you communicate more effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact at work. I know from experience that Grammarly can help you save time on any writing task and ensure you feel confident about what you've produced. In fact, 96% of Grammarly's users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing, and their tone suggestions can help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done. Well, as always, we're going to finish off the podcast with a little blast of questions. Mark, the first one is for you from Chris Partridge, who said, a few weeks ago, I sent you a question about whether it's time for Mattia Binotto to go. At the time, Mark disagreed. Following Ferrari's latest blunder, pitting Leclerc for softs and losing fifth place to Alonso, does this now change your mind?
No, because he's got the two most difficult bits absolutely right after years of Ferrari getting them wrong, which is the pace of the car, the technical prowess of the team, and the culture where people aren't working in fear. But they're the two bits which have traditionally hamstrung Ferrari in recent times, and he's got those. He has managed to get those right. In getting rid of that culture of fear, they haven't replaced it with what is needed, which is a realistic acceptance of the problem without it being made personal. So it just seems as though it's not addressed. Any problems aren't being addressed. I'm sure they're trying, but it's not. It's not a rigorous enough process, but that is just a process problem. Whereas things like getting a car which is a cutting-edge design against teams of the caliber of Red Bull and Mercedes is probably one of the most difficult things you could ever dream of doing, and he's done it. So absolutely not. No, he maybe needs some support. He maybe needs to draw in expertise from somewhere else. But I think you'd be throwing the baby out with the bathwater just changing light bulbs like that.
Next question is for you, Scott, from Ben Johnson, who says, this is the first F1 race following Spa's extensive circuit renovations. What's the verdict from a racing and trackside experience point of view?
Well, I think one of the best things about this is that no one really noticed the difference of Eau Rouge and Radeon, which is exactly the intention. It's not meant to detract from a challenge, from a spectacle point of view. It's just meant to make it a bit safer in the runoff. And then if anybody has a crash, then the car would be better contained and it wouldn't be bouncing back into the, or rather it wouldn't be bouncing back onto the racing line because there would be a bit more room. So that was, I think, honestly, the biggest takeaway for me was that you didn't notice that. One of the things that I really liked, which I don't believe is a change made for Formula One, it's they've added a lot of these gravel traps and tweaked a lot of the runoff areas, mainly for not MotoGP, but motorcycle racing to bring a high level of motorcycle racing back to Spa. But I loved seeing that gravel trap on the outside of La Source because I know what you're going to say because you're probably going to chime in with the same thing you've been saying all weekend, which is going to be a Mansell reference to banning them from using the runoff. But I hated the sight of all the cars disappearing onto the runoff on the exit of La Source. You see it in all kinds of categories. We see it in F1 as well, where someone just lets it run wide and boots the throttle and gains some places, or at least doesn't lose anything by running out wide. And I think that's absolute nonsense. And look at that. We put a physical deterrent on the outside of La Source and no one went wide on the opening lap. It's almost as if proper track limits take care of the issue. So I was really, really happy with that. On the racing side, this wasn't really the racing verdict. Isn't really related to any of the circuit renovations. It's just a Spa thing with these cars. The racing wasn't great. The problem with the 2022 cars is you can follow more closely, but the toe effect in general is less. So a lot of the drivers said after the race that you just got stuck in a train. So it wasn't the most exciting Grand Prix. I am happy that the track is staying on the calendar because I do think it's a classic venue. But something about it just doesn't work in terms of creating great racing on a regular basis. Too many DRS drive-bys and that kind of thing. But again, I think that's sort of an inherent F1 at Spa thing rather than anything that changed on the circuit for this year.
Yeah, my Mansell reference, of course, was to 2010, first year of driver stewards, and he was the driver steward here, and he pushed really hard in the driver's briefing about not using the runoff at La Source on the first lap, which had been important in Raikkonen's victory the previous year. There was lots of complaining about it, oh, we need it, etc., etc. Sure enough, a bunch of the best drivers in the world all got round La Source without taking liberties. So that's quite a good reason for having the gravel trap there, because that kind of plays the Nigel Mansell role. But Mansell, of course, was bang on in 2010, and the gravel trap is right in 2022. Mark, question from Roger Harvey, who says, do you expect drivers taking penalties for engine changes at Spa, of which there were many, to make their new units last until the end of the season?
In certain cases, yes. In the case of the Ferrari ones, not necessarily, no. I think there's still an unresolved issue within that power unit. So, yeah, I'd expect more penalties later in the season.
Coming to you, Scott, also on power unit penalties from Sander van Huyten. With all the power unit related penalties this weekend, has the 3 power units per season limit not completely lost its purpose? If none of the teams are able to finish the season without using at least a fourth one, and with the number of races per season growing, should the limit not be raised to 4 or 5 PUs?
I think the limit could go up to 4. I don't really see the purpose of keeping it at 3 for now. As a general rule, trying to get it was already a stretch to get 7 events out of a power unit. When you then factor in that certain elements change for this year, like the new fuel, which I think has had an impact on the reliability and performance of the internal combustion engine in particular, and then you look at the fact that the calendar is gradually creeping up, and I might be remembering this incorrectly, or I might be conflating two different regulations, but I'm sure there is a mechanism in the regulations that if races go beyond a certain amount, you are meant to go up and down on limits. We had, was it last year, we had the extra MGUK came in. That was 2, I think, before, but that went up to 3. So there is clearly flexibility within the regs to adjust it based on the realities. I need to double check to see who is actually on course at the moment for a penalty-free season, but I can't imagine it's anyone except a few Mercedes drivers, because the Mercedes has been really reliable this year. So it's clearly doable. But I don't know, I just feel like when there are lots of other things keeping costs down, cost cap on the team side, soon there'll be a cost cap for the manufacturers, ever increasing limits on dyno hours and this kind of thing. A fourth power unit is just a nice little safety, because it's going to be they're being used anyway. So it's not like we're saving the team's money. They're using them and then just taking the penalty. So it just seems a bit silly.
Now there's an engine freeze as well. You could argue they can go up, because one of the counter arguments is that if you say it's 3 power units, they'll design it to be a little bit on edge and think, well, we'll take a fourth if we need to. If you make it 4, then it tips into 5. And you just keep kicking the range down as you increase the numbers. But with the engine homologation, perhaps there is now scope to do that without having that effect, because you can't change the engine. The next question mark comes from Thomas Knight, who says, given that the second Williams seat definitely appears to be up for grabs, is Nicholas Latifi not taking the chance to really prove he deserves another year? Albon is driving brilliantly, but I feel Latifi should be a lot closer to him than he has been today.
Yes, you probably got a point. He's been given an ample opportunity really to establish himself and hasn't really got a foothold. He's little glimpses of promise and every now and again, but no, I think if they don't need to take on a budget for that seat, I think his seat is most definitely in danger. Yeah.
Yeah, it's another one of those weekends where, as you say, some flashes of promise, and then you look at the final result in the race, and he's down in 18th after that mistake. He said it was a bit like driving in the wet with the grip levels he had, and he was a bit disappointed with how qualifying went, given he was eliminated in Q1. But yeah, it's very difficult to make a case for Nicholas Latifi, hard worker as he is, and good chap as he is. Scott, a question from Matt Wyatt, who says, maybe this one is for an in-between races podcast. Well, we're going to do the short version here. I think this every year at the Belgian Grand Prix. Why do we need DRS at Spa? I see the benefits of DRS as the least bad solution, which enables overtaking, but I feel like it actively ruins the race at Spa. The cars can overtake plenty well without it. Watching cars cruise past one another down the Kemmel Straight is so painful. Couldn't we trial not having it at, for example, Spa and Montreal and see how we go?
Well, Matt must have preempted the answer I gave just now, because I agree that the DRS is too powerful at a circuit like this. I wonder if the way you could do it is you could judge it on, I don't know, length of straight. So if the straight is shorter than a certain length, you have the DRS is on that straight. But if it isn't, then it's optional. Effectively, you can kill it, because that would just give you a nice little binary regulation to apply, and then it's not totally ad hoc. I wouldn't do it at Montreal necessarily, but I think Spa and Monza, and the reason I'm picking those two is because they're the two that spring to mind as ones that have horrible DRS trains. Because every year we have some people just surprised that there's no good racing at Monza, or that the overtaking is really difficult there. And I think if you left it open to This is a very oversimplified way of saying it, but effectively the natural aerodynamic efficiency of the cars, I think that would just be a bit more interesting. And then that would also encourage teams to be a little bit more aggressive with wing choices, and this, because you're not having that assistance. There was one point today where was it? Was it Russell who came off of Radeon behind Alonso and had Perez behind him, and he was right in the Alpine slipstream, I think. I might be remembering this incorrectly, but I'm sure it was that kind of combination of cars. And the car, I think it was the Mercedes, which is slower in the straight line than the Alpine, just looked really poor down the straight. It wasn't really gaining. That was, I think that must have been at a point where there wasn't DRS or something, but it just stood out to me just watching the way the cars were, because that was just, that showed just what the different wing levels and the actual just fundamental car aerodynamic efficiency can do. Do you really need DRS playing around with that? I don't really think you do. I do think it's always been a sticking plaster. I agree with what he said, that it is a necessary evil, but perhaps sometimes it goes beyond that, because there have been so many times over the years now where the DRS hasn't had the effect it's meant to have, which is just to make the braking zones contestable. Instead, you just have these drive-by passes, which are just frankly ridiculous and very, very boring to watch. They're anti-racing.
Except, of course, for that group of drivers who are stuck behind the extra wide. Williams of Alex Albon, your Lance Strolls, Lando Norris, Yuki Tsunoda, Joe Guan Yu, Daniel Ricciardo. I bet they think the DRS isn't halfway powerful enough.
That's a very good point. I guess it's ultimately the strength of the DRS is in the eye of the beholder, isn't it?
As always, and yes, DRS is always going to be controversial, and would agree that perhaps it was a little bit too powerful here, so maybe there are some ways to evolve it. Well, thanks as always to Mark Hughes and Scott Mitchell Malm for your insight. Head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen, as there's loads to read there from Scott, Mark, myself, Gary Anderson and the rest of the team. Check out our sister podcasts, including Bring Back V10s, which tells classic F1 stories, and also have a look at our video channel on YouTube. With more driver market shenanigans and the Dutch Grand Prix at Zandvoort in the coming week, stay with us for everything you need to know from the world of Formula One.
The Athletic.